It's a special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Another Pints and Politics presented by the Gazette and Iowa Public Radio. Yesterday evening, we gathered at New Bow City Market in Cedar Rapids to talk politics with columnists Linda Waddington and Todd Dorman, as well as political reporter James Lynch of the Gazette. My co-host was Gazette Opinions editor Jennifer Hemmingson. Now, in the second half, we took stock of the Iowa legislative session, but before that, we discussed President Trump's first 100 days. And I started by asking the audience of about 200 people if they thought 100 days was a valid marker to judge any new president.
How many of you say yes, a valid marker? And how many of you say no, you can't do it in 100 days? Okay. Let's go over to our panel.
So where does the 100 days come from, panel? Do you guys have any idea? This has been sort of a benchmark for presidents for a long time, and it's been adopted by some other folks too. 100 days, you better get your ship in order. You better get your agenda rolling. Is this something that is reasonable? What do you think?
I was under the impression that it's a probationary period and that we're going to get to vote again. Is that not right? I could be mixed up.
Instead of 90 days, you get 100 days. But,
right.
Yeah. Well, I think it goes back to FDR, actually. There was talk about what he was going to accomplish in his first 100 days in office, and it just stuck. And so every president since FDR has been judged on what they accomplished in their first 100 days. It's an arbitrary benchmark. I don't know that it really has any significance other than, you know, we love to measure things. And so 100 days is a nice round number.
So who would you say has had the most successful 100 days?
Probably Roosevelt. I mean,
yeah.
I think he had like 15 or 16 really big policy accomplishments. He had a huge Democratic majorities in Congress. So I think Truman had a pretty eventful first 100 days. World War II ended. He dropped 2 atomic bombs. I mean, that was fairly big. I think I read Bill Clinton had the Family Leave Act mm-hmm. in the first 100 days and some other legislation. So there has been accomplishments during that benchmark, but mm-hmm. it depends on, you know, if you've got a crisis going on that can sort of hamper your ability to get things done. If your party controls Congress, that's a big factor. In this case, Trump has a Republican Congress, so it's possible that, you know, you might expect more congressional accomplishments than what he's been able to score so far.
At the same time, nobody's had quite the learning curve that President Trump has had, right? I mean, coming into office without having any governmental experience, sort of very little understanding about how the federal government works. What would you consider, given that framework, what do you think are some of his bigger accomplishments in the first 100 days?
Well, he named a justice to the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
So talk about that a little bit. Neil Gorsuch, he had help from, of course, the Republican leaders in the Senate, including Mitch McConnell and Charles Grassley, in leaving that seat open to be filled by Neil Gorsuch. How significant is that, we have Neil Gorsuch there filling that ninth seat, and it was named by a Republican president, by this president?
Well, I think conservatives think it's highly significant, and they have great expectations for Neil Gorsuch. And as right as he might be as a Supreme Court justice in the eyes of conservatives, I think the next Supreme Court appointment is going to be the really big one, the one that is going to probably end up in nuclear options, because it will really change the balance of the court.
Holding that Supreme Court seat open is probably one of the reasons why Trump was elected president, because there were quite a few Republican voters who had misgivings about him for various reasons, but they knew, or at least they hoped, that he would nominate someone conservative to the court and keep that conservative balance. And that was a big campaign pitch, especially from surrogates, people who campaigned for Trump, you know, trying to convince Republicans to vote for him.
You know, one of the things that fascinates me about the first 100 days is that I think expectations for Donald Trump were somewhat tempered by the fact that he had no experience governing. And we had this all-Republican Congress. And we thought they were going to do a lot of things. Congress really hasn't done much. The president has proposed a lot. The Supreme Court has disposed of a number of things regarding immigration, for example. Congress, sort of like, where have they been? I think that's the real surprise to me, is that Congress hasn't been proposing and doing things even faster than the president. And it just seems like Congress is absent here in this, you know, three-way equation.
Right. We talk a little bit about that, because we've had a slew of executive orders by the president, the immigration, the travel ban I mentioned, the hiring freeze, negotiations, the withdrawal from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, now NAFTA also in question, approval for pipelines, the Dakota Access Pipeline, the Keystone XL Pipeline. He's rolled back anti-coal regulations that were put in place under the Obama administration, a number of other things. Is he sort of at the end of the line in terms of what a president can do by himself? And how will, or how do you see, that relationship with Congress developing so there will eventually be a legislative accomplishment?
Well, based on what we've seen so far, I don't know if we'll see any legislative accomplishments. And that's why it's so surprising to me, with Republicans in control of both the House and the Senate, you'd think they would be on a fast track. Sorry to kind of mix topics here, but looking at what the Iowa Republican-controlled legislature accomplished in 104 days compared to what President Trump and a Republican Congress have done in 100 days, it's like there's no comparison.
Right.
So
I mean,
did Republicans in Congress walk in without a plan?
I mean, I think part of the problem was that the signature promise they made was to repeal Obamacare. And that's an exceedingly difficult thing to do, and basically impossible with the parameters they set out for themselves, because they were going to keep, you know, pre-existing conditions. The kids weren't going to lose their insurance when they're 26, you know, up to 26 years old. They were going to do all of the stuff that people, the polling says people like. They were going to keep. The trouble is, if you get rid of the individual mandate, if you get rid of the subsidies, if you get rid of all the things that Republicans, conservatives don't like, you make the whole thing collapses. So they made a promise they couldn't keep, and now, because they were counting on some of the tax savings and things from fulfilling that unkeepable promise, they're sort of stuck. And I don't know exactly how they, the only way you get out of it is you pass some sort of bill that kicks 24 million people off of their health insurance. So it's the rock in a hard place, and Trump and boulders and, you know, all of that.
If you've just joined us, this is a special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, Pints and Politics, presented by the Gazette and Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer, along with my co-host Jennifer Hemmingson of the Gazette. You've been listening to Todd Dorman, Linda Waddington, and James Lynch of the Gazette. We have a large audience here at the Nubo City Market in Cedar Rapids. So glad to have a pint and to talk over politics. In a little bit, we're going to talk about the 2017 Iowa legislative session, asking our audience, how have you been affected by the laws that have changed? Which laws are of special concern to you? If I can go back to one of the legislative attempts that was made here earlier in the first 100 days here, it's still a work in progress, I guess, is that replacement of the Affordable Care Act, of Obamacare, I guess. The new acronym we would have to learn is the American Health Care Act. Do you see Congress coming together, particularly the Freedom Caucus, coming together in a different way to enact a replacement? And how will that replacement look based on what you're hearing out of Washington?
Do you want to know if just the Republicans are going to be able to come together, or if the American people are also going to be behind it?
Okay, I'm just going to be cool, calculating, and political here. I want to know if the Republican majority in Congress will get together with this president and hammer out a compromise. They have the power to do it. They don't have to necessarily pay that much attention to the Democrats. Will that happen as they initially tried? And what form will it take if they do? While you're thinking there, I want to know from our audience, clap if you or someone in your family
is personally affected by the Affordable Care Act. So we're going to take, based on that response, that this has quite a constituency, is on people's minds. So,
well, go ahead.
No, you're fine. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I mentioned before that the problem is that in order to keep the popular stuff, you have to, I mean, it's almost impossible to keep all the popular stuff and keep and get rid of the stuff that conservatives don't like and keep the thing, you know, so that it works. Well, now the talk is they don't get rid of the popular stuff. They'll leave it up to the states to get rid of if the states want to decide not to cover pre-existing conditions. And so this is what often happens when the federal government has a decision it can't make. It sends it to the states. So you'll have what you have now. You'll have some states where the healthcare system works really well for a lot of people, and then some states where it doesn't work so well, and that's...
Can the idea of insurance work under those conditions when in some states perhaps you only have the elderly, the really sick, insured, and the 25-year-olds who have, you know, in their mind, not a care in the world, no reason for insurance, they get to opt out.
Well, and just to pile on your question there, I mean, you're hearing more people talk again about the public option, which is something that died before ACA, because people thought it wasn't politically possible. Are we in a position, paradoxically, where public option is actually the best case scenario?
You know, basically, when Donald Trump was on the campaign trail, he campaigned for single payer. I mean, that's essentially what he was saying, that he was going to provide health insurance, that the government was going to be there, that everybody was going to have it. That's single payer. But now you get into the thick of it, you know, once you start paddling through that swamp, you realize that it is more difficult. And he's even come out and said, you know, who knew this was so difficult?
It's complicated.
But I think what Congress is grappling with is something that every one of us sitting here tonight already knows, and that's healthcare is freaking expensive. You know, if you actually are a very healthy person, you know, praise be. But if you even start having, you know, the smallest issues or, you know, chronic conditions, it gets very expensive very quickly. And eventually somebody has to pay for that. And if we're not going to do it through some type of subsidies, you know, then we have to decide how else we're going to do it. And that's the impasse. The impasse is this worth a government investment? And that's the question that's got to be answered before we can solve healthcare.
Well, and yeah. And probably the most miraculous thing with regard to healthcare that they've accomplished in the first 100 days is to make the Affordable Care Act popular. I mean, it's now polling well over 55%. The minute you start messing with it, all of a sudden people like it. So I'm hoping climate change, other things go the same way. But I guess we'll see what happens.
So I just want to nod to the fact that we're getting a lot of questions from folks that are clear that feelings are still running high from the election. People are still incredibly concerned, borderline terrified, about this administration and about what it might mean. There's a lot of unanswered questions, which leads to a lot of, you know, potential horrifying scenarios that folks are asking about. What is it going to take for this administration to build enough trust to be able to get some traction and get some good work done? Okay, impeach Trump. What else?
I'm not sure that building trust is part of the plan. I mean, from what we've seen in the first 100 days is say one thing, do something else. Never let, you know, you keep everybody off balance. It's not a matter of building trust. It's the exact opposite. With not only domestically, but with our foreign policy, we say one thing and then do the other. So I'm not sure that this administration's plan is to build trust with voters.
Right.
I think it's more like keep everybody off balance so they don't know what's coming next.
I will say, at least on foreign policy, I'm almost sort of glad that they're doing something else than what they promised to do, because some of the promises that they made were probably the wrong thing to do. I mean, he's actually, and you know, maybe you disagree with this stuff, but at least he seems to be on foreign policy to be sort of becoming more of a normal Republican president in that way, which makes me feel a little bit more comfortable, at least in that realm. I mean, they're saber-rattling on North Korea. I think they are probably pulling back a little bit more than maybe I would have expected. I was a little bit worried that they were going to go too far on that. So from a foreign policy standpoint, I don't know if trust has been established, but I'm not quite as frightened, I guess, as I was when during the campaign when he was talking about all of the things that they were gonna defeat ISIS in a month and all of these things that had seemed sort of, you know, far-fetched at the time.
How do you see our congressional delegation reacting, our six members of Congress from Iowa reacting to the new situation under the 100-day-old administration? Any observations?
You know, I was extremely pleased that Joni Ernst questioned the travel expenses of Donald Trump. I have long admired Joni for her work on veterans issues, for her work in other areas. But I think, unfortunately, it took a lot of courage to stand there and question that and say, well, you know, maybe this isn't quite in the best interest of our country. So I was very proud of that.
On the other hand, you know, Chuck Grassley says, hey, when he goes down to Mar-a-Lago to meet with Xi Jinping, that's work. That's not a vacation. That's work. So he doesn't have a problem with that. I think, you know, members of Congress kind of look at their priorities more than they look at the president's priorities. And as long as they can push those priorities and make some progress, they're happy, regardless of what the president's agenda is.
Well, and it's going to be, and the two members of Congress that are in the interesting situation are David Young and Rod Blum. In and of, you know, they're going to face re-election in 2018. Steve King is in a district that, well, you know, it's Steve King's district. And needless to say more. And Dave Loebsack is in a position as a minority member, the only Democrat in the delegation. But, you know, Blum and Young are going to face an electorate in a midterm election, which is usually bad for the party in power in the White House, and could be really bad if the resistance we're hearing really mobilizes the way that we hear talk of, and if Trump's approval ratings don't improve and they don't make, you know, get more accomplishments done. I mean, so they're in a position right now with all of those unknowns. They don't want to get too close to Trump, but they don't want to run away. So they're just sort of trying to figure out a balance act. Rod Blum opposed the first incarnation of the American Health Care Act. And, you know, we'll see where he's at, you know, with the Freedom Caucus on this next one. But, I mean, it's a pretty delicate dance because you just don't know where things are going to go by November of 2018.
So how much does 2018 depend on a thorough investigation of Russia and with Republican majority in everywhere you look, are we going to get a thorough investigation of Russia?
I have my doubts, and that's one of my biggest concerns about what I've seen from Congress in this first 100 days is that when you think about some foreign government, any foreign government interfering in our election, not even interfering, but just being involved, I mean, sticking their nose on, you know, under the tent, you might say. I can't imagine Congress not being on a fast track investigating that. I mean, it's just beyond me that we haven't had a much more aggressive and thorough investigation, regardless of which party is in power. That's my major concern, is that sort of this lackadaisical approach to investigating Russian interference.
Based on what we know, these investigations are in early stages, will take months. We want to find out what were the nature of the conversations that the Russians had, with whom did they have these conversations. What do you see as possible outcomes here? That's where I kind of get stuck when we have... What if there is collusion proven? What happens? Dare we question the legitimacy of a president based on this, or is it all to be incorporated in a future election under the heading, lessons learned, let's not have this happen again?
I think for me, it's not so much the question of collusion at this point until we know more, but just the idea that somebody, you know, there was this attempt, and it seems pretty clear that there was an attempt to interfere with the election. Whether it had any impact on the outcome, I don't know, but just an attempt. I mean, I don't know, understand how this is any different than the Russian army landing on the shores of the United States and invading us. I mean, this is cyber warfare.
James, how long has spycraft existed? This is another step, admittedly, in spycraft, but we engage in espionage and have for our entire way back to George Washington.
I agree, and I don't think we're going to have black and white answers ever on this, but I think we need an aggressive investigation, and I don't see that happening at this point.
I think the investigation will have the resources to buy a very big rug and a very big broom. They're going to sweep it under the rug. I mean, that's what's going to happen. Time's going to pass. New things are going to come. I mean, we already saw with the Syria situation that they basically, you know, relations with Russia eroded a little bit, and I think they were pointing at that and saying, look, see, we're not colluding with Russia.
Will that satisfy the voters? Will that satisfy the electorate?
I hope not.
You know, will that wear down the electorate?
I hope no matter what comes out of the investigation, if there is an investigation, that it's actually that we had 9 hearings on Benghazi, 12 hearings on a video produced by an anti-abortion group regarding Planned Parenthood, and we've yet to have one hearing that I'm aware of regarding Russia. You know, but what I want to get at is that we can't base these national security questions on partisanship. It, like James said, it shouldn't matter who's in charge of Congress. Congress should be concerned, no matter who won the election, that people, you know, interfered, I guess. I don't know how else to say it. They interfered. Well,
after a short break, we return to our discussion, recorded last evening at New Bow City Market in Cedar Rapids. Our panelists, columnists Linda Waddington and Todd Dorman, as well as political reporter James Lynch of the Gazette. When we return, we focus on state politics. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
This is a special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming back to the second half of our show, presented by the Gazette and Iowa Public Radio, I'm Ben Kiefer with Jennifer Hemmingson. And our panelists from the Gazette, James Lynch, Todd Dorman, and Linda Waddington. Last half hour, Jennifer, you and I quizzed our panel on mostly federal politics. We want to go to state politics this half hour. Well, we knew back in November that voters dealt Iowa Republicans their first unified government in 20 years. The 2017 legislative session was, we knew, going to be amazing. Whether it was amazing like winning the lottery or amazing like having a windstorm tear off the roof of your house, that depends on your politics. Let's review what the legislature accomplished, what it means for Iowans, and what it means for 2018 and beyond, like the federal view. We have so much to pick from. Where do you want to start, Jennifer?
We do. Well, legislators wasted no time in getting a lot of big sort of base priorities taken care of this year. What would you say, if you had to choose, their number one most significant piece of legislation was? What's going to have the greatest impact for good or bad on the state for years to come?
Well, collective bargaining is going to affect a lot of people right away. 180,000 public employees will be affected almost immediately, I mean, beginning in July, and maybe even earlier, because a lot of school boards and teachers unions rushed to reach settlements on their contracts even before the law went into effect. So I think that's going to have a big impact. You know, Republicans had talked for years about doing something on collective bargaining, that it needed to be rebalanced, it needed to be tweaked. I don't think anyone anticipated, or at least no one other than the Republicans in the legislature, anticipated that they were going to gut the law and basically, I mean, it's just a shell of what it was for the past 40 years. So I think that's pretty significant. They say it will be significant in that it will save Iowa taxpayers money. That remains to be seen, but it certainly will have an impact on those public employees.
I wanted to raise a family planning services, the changes there, the couple of bills that affected that. We now have a 20-week abortion ban. Most abortions in Iowa banned after 20 weeks of pregnancy. Also, the controversy now, the new law involving Planned Parenthood, the blockage of state funding going to Planned Parenthood and any other clinics that provide abortions. Here's a question jumping off from that from one of our audience members. What are they doing to replace Planned Parenthood? Linda, do you want to tackle this issue?
Well, we aren't replacing Planned Parenthood because in Iowa we don't have the infrastructure medically to replace Planned Parenthood, which is something, unfortunately, that lawmakers knew before they disqualified Planned Parenthood from reimbursement funding. And you know, there was a lot of contention that perhaps Planned Parenthood was taking money, taxpayer money, and funneling it directly or indirectly to abortion services. One thing that you need to understand about that is that Planned Parenthood was being reimbursed for services they had already provided. So if Planned Parenthood did a pap smear, if they provided prenatal services, if they dispensed prenatal vitamins, if they did a referral to a mammogram, those are reimbursable services under Medicaid. So it wasn't like Planned Parenthood was giving a stack of federal or state dollars and just told to go and do whatever they needed to do with it. About 17 years ago, I was pregnant with our second daughter and was seeing a high-risk OBGYN. And I was seeing a high-risk OBGYN because we had already gone through 3 pregnancy losses. One in each trimester of pregnancy. And so when I sat down with that doctor, one of the things that I wanted to make clear to her is that if there ever came a time, and I understood with the 3 other losses, there wasn't an option, you know, for them to pick and choose whether they would save me or save the child. But with this particular pregnancy that I was experiencing, I wanted to be sure that she understood that if she had to make that choice, that my preference was for her to pick the child. And she very patiently and gently explained to me that that's not how it works. That when you're an OBGYN, that the woman is the patient, and that's your priority. And so how you know that lawmakers wrote this 20-week ban and that they didn't speak at all with physicians or understand the position of the physicians is because when you read that bill, you see that even in the very rare circumstances that a woman could qualify for a late-term abortion, that abortion has to be performed in a way best designed to preserve the life of the fetus, which throws what OBGYN doctors do completely upside down and on its head. And if you're going to have a later term abortion, you have 2 options, basically. You have induction or DNE, dilation and extraction. Both of those are designed to protect the women, not the fetus.
So clearly, abortion continues to be a very emotional topic, and it's a very contentious subject,
yeah.
And it's very divisive. And so we have a really great question from the audience that I'd like to ask.
Sure.
Which is, you know, so I was talking with a friend who said that one of the reasons that it continues to be this hot and this ugly is that it was decided by the Supreme Court and not by Congress. Our audience member wonders what it would take to make abortion law a settled issue and no longer a hot topic. Do we get past this?
Probably not. The passions run high on both sides or all sides of this issue. And that was clear in the debate around the bill that the legislature passed. There are people who fervently believe that it's not the government's right or the it's not right for government to make this decision. It's people who see it as very black and white, that a life is a life is a life is a life. No. I mean, I don't think it matters whether it's a court's decision or whether Congress passes a law or the state legislature passes a law. There has been 40-some years of, well, more than that, but I mean 40-some years since Roe v. Wade that people have been fighting over this, and they're not going to stop fighting over it. It's an issue that divides us, and it's going to continue to divide us. I think whether you agree with the decision the legislature made or not, how they went about it probably didn't lend itself to any sort of agreement or sort of acceptance of that decision. I think it made it hard for people, whether they were on the winning side or the losing side, to say, I feel good about this.
If you've just joined us, this is a special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. With James Lynch, Todd Dorman, and Linda Waddington of the Gazette. I'm Ben Kiefer with my co-host, Jennifer Hemmingson of the Gazette. And we're talking a little bit this half hour about state politics, what's happened in the 2017 legislative session before a live audience at the New Bow City Market in Cedar Rapids, trying to get in as many questions as we can before the hour ends. I want to get our panelists' reaction to what the Iowa Republican Party chairman, Jeff Kaufman, called the most monumental piece of pro-Second Amendment legislation in Iowa's history. Of course, he's referring to the changes in Iowa's firearms laws, really an overhaul that included many different facets, including the stand your ground provision, which eliminates a duty to retreat. That would be interpreted by courts, I suppose, in any special circumstance. Also, though, allowing children to use handguns while under adult supervision. Reflections on how our handgun laws have changed under this new legislation.
Wow.
it's wide open, James. Walk right in.
You know, let me say right from the start that growing up, I hunted. I enjoyed shooting, you know, target shooting, that sort of thing. I do own a gun, although it is not in operational condition. It's more of an heirloom than a weapon. There are a lot of parts of this law that I can live with, but, you know, the stand your ground provisions give me real pause, because it's not just a matter of protecting your own life, but protecting property. And I don't equate those two. You know, it's one thing to, you know, self-defense is one thing, but defending somebody who might be stealing your bike or your car or whatever, that's an entirely different thing. And I think that's where a lot of people had a problem with this bill, is that it was just sort of carte blanche, use your weapon.
Well, and I mean, I tend to be, you know, I tend to be pro-gun rights in a lot of ways. I grew up in a small town. People had guns. They were a tool. We used them for hunting. We used them when they needed to be. They weren't sort of a political fetish item that people showed off to show what side of the fence they were on. But, I mean, my problem with this stuff, you know, collective bargaining, this bill, it's a scope thing. I mean, here we have one election. Granted, Republicans won control of the state house. They did very well on election night. Does one election sort of give you the license to make these wholesale changes in laws that have been around for decades? And I'm just, I mean, I understand mandates and political capital and all of that. I just have a real problem with any legislature, whichever party it is, sort of waltzing in and saying, well, we won one election, so let's tear all of these big institutional things out by the roots within a matter of weeks or months and replace them and expect everybody to be okay with that. I just think that's sort of lousy lawmaking within the scope of having a legislature that has to represent the entire state, not just the constituencies that got you elected.
And that brings us to this really great audience question here, which is, how sustainable is all this? So we've seen a really aggressive state legislature. They've gone in and done all the big ticket items. I can't think of one that they left on the plate. So how easy or hard would it be to repeal these laws that were passed this session? Or are we talking about a 2018 that's going to be sort of a swing back?
One way to look at it is that this session, lawmakers passed about 180 some laws. A lot of those were passed 99-1 or 50-0 in the Senate. They're bipartisan. They're really non-cons or non-controversial. If you go back to when Democrats took control, one-party control of the governor's office and the legislature, they passed even more laws in that first year that they had complete control. And if you look at the first year of one-party control, that's pretty typical. Actually, the output this year or productivity this year was below normal. But how sustainable is it? You know, as soon as Democrats take control of the legislature, they're going to start adding to collective bargaining rights, going back to what we had previous to this year. And you can pick pretty much any of those major. Workers' comp is another one. They'll restore some of those rights that workers had. So this is, you know, you can look at it as the pendulum swinging back and forth. I agree with Todd that I don't know that one election gives you any special insight or authority to make wholesale changes. But from a political standpoint, you have one opportunity, you take it.
Yeah, and I think the other piece to that is that when we have had seen these split houses, so when we had Democratic control of the Senate and we had Republican control of the House, that the House might propose doing something with collective bargaining and the Senate wouldn't even hear about it. So, you know, I also think it goes both ways, that if you're constantly saying, no, we aren't even going to open this for discussion, no matter how close this is to our constituencies, that you set yourself up for these big, massive changes in law. You know, we could have looked at smaller things. We could have looked at arbitration, but some Senate Democrats wouldn't allow it. You know, and the same thing with abortion laws. I mean, we could have looked at these 20-week bans with exceptions for fetal anomalies or exceptions for rape and incest, but nobody even wanted to open that door. We have to be willing to have these bigger conversations about even the controversial issues, or all we're going to see is this pendulum swinging back and forth one way or the other.
Well, the best example is we had a 40-year-old bipartisan collective bargaining law, lasted for 40 years. This collective bargaining bill passed this session is not going to last 40 years. I mean, it's just not. So do you want to build stuff that lasts, or do you want to win partisan advantage this election and then lose it the next? I mean, I guess that's the politics. You basically just lurch back and forth and win today and lose tomorrow. And I mean, and meanwhile, you get lousy policy. I mean, that's just.
As we come to the end of this time together on Pints and Politics, a special edition of River to River with Todd Dorman, Linda Waddington, and James Lynch, and my co-host Jennifer Hemmingson, I wanted to point to a couple changes in law that have come out of the 2017 legislative session here in Iowa that perhaps enjoy a little bit more bipartisan support. I want our audience to weigh in on this. We had a spike in road deaths here in Iowa and also nationwide. At the same time, of course, over the last 5-10 years, we've seen the proliferation of this. How many times have you looked at the driver who isn't paying attention next to you in the lane or in front of you and said, would you stop looking at your phone and look at the road, please? So we have now distracted driving in the form of texting while driving, a primary offense. Who's happy with that?
And finally, also from me, that I had Patty come up the break from Dubuque. She's here. She's been a Pints and Politics fan and audience member for a long time. She's very happy with the legalization of fireworks. How many are happy with that? Okay. A little bit less so. I just wanted to throw those in before the hour ends. Do you have any other questions?
I have a couple of really interesting questions I want to make sure we get in. One audience member wrote, I'm just going to read it, okay? So most Americans are probably more moderate than very liberal or very conservative. So why doesn't the press and media cover stories from a middle perspective? Okay. I'm going to follow it up immediately with the real question for my panel. Is this fake news? Is this fake news tonight? Are you guys fake newsing us? Can I even get a verb?
Fake news. No.
I have not presented any alternative facts that I know of, but I may have made predictions that will prove to be alternative facts later.
We have two definitions of fake news, right? One, definition one is news that is not backed up by any evidence that is, you know, untrue. The other definition is anything you disagree with.
This is the greatest political panel that's ever been held in the history of the world. There's that.
That's
best
definitely
looking
true.
Too.
Definitely true. But so we talked a little bit about how language and about how people aren't talking to each other, and we're just like, I've got the ball, I'm going to run with it, and you guys can just like go home and cry and buttercup and all that giant jazz. So media, representatives of the media, like, how do you bridge that? Where are you at?
I'm not really sure how to deal with it because it's sort of a foreign concept to me, quite frankly. It's an oxymoron, fake news.
I want to plug a documentary that I just watched. It's called The Brainwashing of My Dad. And it's about this guy who drove back and forth in a commute and he listened to talk radio all the time. So he was this person and became this person from listening just to talk radio. And it's kind of interesting, just kind of this whole idea that what you listen to, especially those things that you listen to in private instead of part of a group, so you're all protected tonight, that they kind of get into your head and they kind of fester and they kind of shift your perceptions. As far as what to do about fake news, I don't know, because frankly, I'm a big fan of the First Amendment and of people saying what they want to say. So it makes it a little bit more difficult to kind of navigate those waters. But I think we're definitely, you know, as a country, able to look at those people who are elected officials and call them out when we plainly see that what they're telling us is manufactured from what reality is.
There are legitimate credibility issues regarding the media. I mean, there always are and there always have been. But I do think the fake news label has sort of become kind of the stick your fingers in your ears and say, la, 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 I'm not listening to you anymore because I don't like what you have to say. But that doesn't mean that the credibility issues go away, that we don't have to consider, you know, what, you know, how we're gathering news, who we're talking to, all of those things. So what perspectives we're listening to.
Any concluding remarks as we look towards 2018? We have a legislative session before an election in 2018. Any thoughts on what will happen in 2018 in the State House?
I think we're going to see more attempts to expand gun rights. We'll see more attempts to restrict abortion. We'll see another effort to do something on water quality, medicinal or medical marijuana. I think this year people sort of, they thought they would do more than they did. So I think we're going to see more of the same. But I also think we'll see attempt to do tax cuts, do some sort of friendly legislation that will make voters feel good as they go to the polls in 2018.
And that ends a discussion recorded last night at New Bow City Market in Cedar Rapids. Another edition of Pints and Politics presented by the Gazette and Iowa Public Radio. Joining me were Todd Dorman, Linda Waddington, James Lynch, and Jennifer Hemmingson of the Gazette. Emily Woodbury produced and edited this hour. Our sound engineer was Jim Davies. Assistance from Lindsay Moon and Ben Stanton. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.